and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. A Chicago man is facing murder charges in the fatal shooting of two Israeli embassy staffers in Washington, D.C.
Who drives the bus?
We do.
Who drives the train?
We do.
Who drives the city?
We do.
Public transit workers are pushing for more funding as the budget deadline looms in Springfield. And a new children's book explores growing up in an immigrant family. First off tonight, a Chicago man is being charged in the fatal shooting of two Israeli embassy staff members in Washington, D.C. FBI agents descended on Albany Park on the city's north side this morning to search a home connected to Elias Rodriguez. Police say Rodriguez attacked the victims yesterday evening as they were leaving an event at the Capitol Jewish Museum and yelled, "Free, free Palestine," as he was detained. It comes as Israel launched another major offensive in the Gaza Strip and as Jewish communities are on alert amid a national rise in anti-Semitic incidents. Our Matt Masterson joins us now with more. Matt, what do we know about the suspected gunmen?
Yeah, 31-year-old Elias Rodriguez. He's now, as of this afternoon, charged with multiple counts of first-degree murder and also some felony firearm charges as well. Federal authorities say that he could also face terrorism charges down the road. Those are yet to be filed. It appears he's a Chicago native. He now lives in Albany Park, where that FBI search occurred this morning. He apparently was a former University of Illinois Chicago student who now works for the American Osteopathic Association, a Chicago-based group that represents osteopathic physicians. And based on his own comments and social media postings, he appears like he had been heavily influenced by the war in Gaza. As you said, he had targeted people coming out of the Capitol Jewish Museum. He reportedly shouted "Free Palestine" as he was being arrested after the shooting. And he had a Justice for Wadea photo in his home window, a reference, of course, to the six-year-old boy, Palestinian boy, who was murdered in suburban Plainfield back in 2023.
Representative Brad Schneider from Illinois is the co-chair of the Congressional Jewish Caucus. He spoke at a news conference outside the museum today. Here's what he said.
We have seen a rise of anti-Semitism that has been unprecedented in my lifetime. So as we gather here today, we are overwhelmed by emotions of grief at the loss of two beautiful young people.
Matt, what other local reaction have you heard?
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who is himself Jewish and had a member of his staff actually at this event in Washington where the shooting occurred, said he was horrified by what happened. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson said anti-Semitism and hate have no place in our nation at all. We also heard from one of Rodriguez's neighbors, John Wayne Fry, who said he was sad and disappointed to hear about the shooting and the ongoing war in Gaza. He said that he never interacted much with Rodriguez. They live in the same apartment building, a few doors down. But he said he appeared to just be a normal, friendly guy. He wishes he had spoken with Rodriguez more about the war in Gaza, something they both appeared to be very influenced by, and said if he had had the chance to speak with him about this, he would have tried to talk him out of the shooting, saying violence is never the answer for a situation like this.
And lastly, Matt, what do we know about the victims?
Yeah, so it was two people, Yaron Lashinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram, two members of the Israeli embassy, who were both in Washington, D.C. at this young diplomat's reception. Milgram was 26. She was an American. Lashinsky was a 30-year-old Israeli citizen. And according to an Israeli official, they were a young couple. They had been dating, and Lashinsky had recently purchased a wedding ring with the intent of proposing to her in Jerusalem just next week.
Okay. Heartbreaking story, Matt. Thank you.
And thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Matt's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. And now to some more of today's top stories. Lawsuits filed in Illinois and Indiana today say Heights Crematory failed to properly treat and cremate the remains of more than 30 people.
When a family member comes to place their loved one in their final resting place, they expect that the funeral home or crematory will fulfill their obligations in a sacred manner. And this has been a gross disruption of that process, denying these families of closure.
One of the attorneys you just heard from there says that after filing one lawsuit for Darla Smith alleging the gross mishandling and negligence of her husband's remains, they received a tidal wave of calls from other families fearing the same had happened to their loved ones. The complaints allege the crematory and its affiliates improperly stored remains, bodies were commingled with other bodies, and in some instances, families received the wrong remains entirely. The Chicago Blackhawks have a new head coach. The team announced today the hiring of Jeff Blashill. He previously coached the Detroit Red Wings for 7 seasons before being fired. Blashill succeeds Luke Richardson, who was fired by the team in December. Hawks fans are hoping for a turnaround after the team finished last in the Central Division this year and second to last in the league for the last 2 seasons. If you're planning to travel this Memorial Day weekend, you can expect lots of company. The Illinois Tollway estimates 8 million drivers to take a pass through the tollway. The agency says Friday will be the busiest with nearly 2 million expected vehicles. Auto Club AAA expects more than 2 million Illinois residents to travel at least 50 miles from home between Thursday and Monday, either by car, plane, or buggy. IDOT and the Tri-State Tollway are reminding drivers of ongoing construction zones, though some non-emergency closures will be suspended. We have more information on our website. And Chicago beaches are open for swimming starting tomorrow, marking the unofficial start to summer. Temperatures are expected to top out at 60 degrees over the holiday weekend. The Chicago Park District says it has recruited enough lifeguards to have all 22 beaches open for swimming 7 days a week, all until Labor Day. If you're not quite ready to take a dip in Lake Michigan, though, because it's probably still cold, you can hold out a few more weeks and wait until the city pools open on June 21st. Still to come, a local author and illustrator captures experiences growing up being first generation in a new children's book. But up next, the funding challenges facing Chicago transit agencies as lawmakers face a looming budget deadline in Springfield.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
We are just days away from the end of the Illinois General Assembly's spring session, and among the many thorny issues lawmakers are tackling, the future of Chicagoland public transit. CTA, Metra, and Pace are facing a $770 million hole in their budget, but lawmakers have been clear that they aren't coming through with any more money unless they see reforms to how those agencies are run. But what those reforms look like and where the money will come from, well, that has yet to be resolved. Here's what one rider had to say at a rally yesterday.
I'm worried that I will have to leave the city. I'm worried that other people won't be able to get where they're going. And I am worried about all the excellent workers for the RTA system in its entirety.
Joining us to discuss the looming deadline and the impact of transit are Penny McCoach, president of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 308, a union that represents Chicago Transit Authority workers. Orlando Rojas, a train conductor at Metra and legislative representative at Sheet Metal Air Rail Transportation Union Local 653. And Audrey Wenning, senior director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Thank you all for joining us. Penny McCoach, that clip we heard came from a rally backing a proposal from a number of labor groups. That's an effort you've supported. What kinds of reforms might we see from that proposal?
Well, a number of reforms that you may see from that proposal is one of them is safety for the public as well as the employees, better ridership for the public as well. But more so, safety is the number one priority in the reforms. Designated police force and things of that nature.
Yeah, we've heard, from legislators about safety concerns, and I want to get to those. Audrey Wenning, other proposals have gone farther than this bill, backed by labor groups, perhaps as far as calling, for merging all bus and rail service into one new agency. What would be the advantage of going quite so far?
Yes, well, We really would like to see the region take a rider-centered proposal where we
have
different functions that are handled at the regional level. For example, if we had all fare policy handled at the regional level so that riders could transfer between different systems and not have to pay two fares. If we had all service planning handled at the regional level so that connections could be timed well. So we really think there's a lot of opportunity to have everything integrated in a way that it makes it really easy and appealing for riders to travel around the region using transit and leave their car behind.
And, you know, Audrey, when you speak with lawmakers about these different, needs, these different passenger-centric ideas, what sort of a reception do you get? Do you think they're, aware of how disjointed the system can sometimes feel?
Yes, I'm down in Springfield right now and have been talking to legislators over the past few days, as have many others. And we're hearing that a lot of legislators really are seeing the potential of transformation for the transit system. They feel like this is a turning point. It can be a turning point for the future. And they hear from their constituents about difficulties with ghost buses and difficulties transferring. And they understand that we need to do better. And they really want to see those reforms before they come up with a large amount of money. But they know that they need to do that as well.
Yeah, certainly if those things are going hand in hand, there is quite a bit of urgency here. Orlando Rojas, we heard Penny McCoach and have heard many others bring up safety concerns, both for passengers and for frontline workers. What sorts of concerns have you heard from folks about what they experience on the job?
You know, there has been a desire for more police presence on their stations, at the stations, on the trains themselves, throughout the system, really. And even I know Metra has had a difficult time at times getting the police force up to where it wants to be. I mean, it makes a difference, certainly. Having the option to be able to call and have a designated police force for us is critical, and we need to do that. I think that it can be expanded, and I think the United We Move bill sets the stage for that, not just at Metra, but for the entire system. It's critical. People want safety first. They want to be able to get from point A to point B safely. Yeah, and on time, and on clean trains, comfortable. So I think that it's a key component, and I think the legislation before us, it provides that.
And Orlando Rojas, if lawmakers don't come through with this money, or if it's perhaps in limbo for a while, what kinds of impacts are you worried about from service cuts?
So my understanding is that in order to achieve a 20% financial reduction realize a savings of 20%, you'd have to cut service by up to 40%. There's certain fixed costs that the transit agencies have, whether it's fully funded or not, they're obligated to meet those costs. So where they have the most room is in service cuts, unfortunately. And that's the actual service that we provide. Now you're talking 40% reduction. Obviously, the people that I work with are concerned about, cuts to workers. And so what that means for their families, being able to provide for their families, and that's a huge concern for all of us. And, it's not just the city of Chicago. It really is the region. I know for Metra, there's a lot of workers in the suburbs as well as in the city. And it really would be a huge impact for the entire region. You know, we take the money we earn and we spend it back in our communities. And that multiplier effect goes both ways. You know, for every dollar spent in transit, there's a 13x multiplier. But it works the other way, too. You know, taking a dollar out of the economy really you're taking 13 for everyone. So I know that on paper it seems like a savings, but in the end it would affect not only the lives of all the transit workers, the people that provide or that depend on the service we provide, but really the entire economy in the region.
Yeah, potentially quite a widespread impact. You know, Penny McCoach, that United We Move bill that Orlando referenced, this is the measure that labor groups have been pushing and talking about with lawmakers. Do the proposals in that bill, essentially sort of strengthening the RTA, strengthening coordination, but leaving the structure largely in place, do you feel like you've been getting a good reception from lawmakers who have been really hungry for reform to the way the system's run?
So I do get the that lawmakers do reform is going to help with everything that's going on with the transit system. But without funding, the reform, and that's what our concerns are.
Audrey Wenning, in terms of the funding, in terms of the conversations happening down in Springfield, sometimes lawmakers drag their feet a little bit on looking at specific revenue streams. Do you feel like they've reached a point in the conversation where it's looking like we may have the money come through before the end of May?
We know that legislators are talking seriously about a range of funding sources, and they're getting into details. I think that's something that they do kind of amongst themselves a little more than talking out in the open until they've found the solution. But I'm optimistic. I think they realize that the consequences will be devastating. I mean, I think we see that Penny's in her car right now because of the traffic. She couldn't get to the studio, right? And we absolutely need transit in our region. Our region is going to be paralyzed if we shut down 40% of the transit system. We have the second highest level of congestion in the country. And not to mention transit's impacts on air quality. We have all kinds of health impacts from emissions from driving, climate change, and economic impacts that Orlando was mentioning. So I think people understand that the Chicago region is really an economic engine, and also there's a lot of congestion, and so we need to make transit not only fill gaps, but make it even stronger and make it attractive for people to ride, and that's good for everybody.
Well, certainly there are going to be a lot of conversations over the next few days, but that's where we'll have to leave this conversation. Penny McCoach, Orlando Rojas, Audrey Wenning, thank you all for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And up next, a local children's author on her latest book.
Whether it's connecting with extended family from afar or taking pride in your heritage in the U.S., growing up as a child of immigrants can come with many complex experiences. Local writer and illustrator Jackie Alcantara draws from her own childhood to help kids navigate their diverse identities in her new book called Tios and Primos, Spanish for aunts, uncles, and cousins. And joining us now is the book's author and illustrator, Jacqueline Alcantara. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this book, it tells the story of a young girl's visit to Honduras, where her family is from. She's excited to meet her extended family. Of course, you're also Honduran. How did some of your childhood experiences inspire the story of this book?
Well, I'm half Honduran. My father's side of the family lives there. And growing up in Chicago, just, you know, really wanting to connect with that part of your identity. But luckily, we were able to take a lot of trips there, and I was given opportunities to connect with my cousins and aunts and uncles. But, you know, when you arrive there and you realize the Spanish that you know is only getting you so far, and you're missing out on conversations and jokes, and you really want to bond with people further, that was kind of when I would get frustrated. And so when I was starting to dive into writing this book, I started to remember all of the ways that my family really made me feel so welcome and so accepted and really part of the family despite that language barrier.
Yeah, and your character in the book, the little girl, she has a little bit of anxiety about meeting the family and how's it gonna go. But like you said, the family welcomes her in the book, and it all works out.
Yeah.
You have to read the book, though. I don't want to give it away. Honduras is often an underrepresented part of Latino culture. Lots of stereotypes, of course, about all of it. What was it like for you to bring specifically Honduran identity to life through words and pictures as an illustrator?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, drawing from your personal experience is always the best, right, when writing and illustrating. So it was a natural thing for me to want to create and want to draw and paint these parts of Honduras that mean so much to me and are also contrasting a lot of the negative rhetoric that we hear about Central America, Central American families. So it's, you know, kind of a great time to have such a positive book out about how loving families are there, how beautiful of a country it is. So it feels great to be able to share a positive story for people to see.
Well, and to that point, you know, we are in a time when many people from immigrant communities are facing challenges with current immigration policies and xenophobic attitudes. How do you think your book sort of contributes to, you know, this current national context that we're in?
Great question. you know, I guess my hope for it is that it's just contrasting that. And kids and families are able to see positive depictions of their culture that are maybe very different from other sources of media that they're being, you know, inundated with, and that they can sit with books like this and others and feel pride and about their own identity and curious about their heritage if they have grown up here and they haven't visited it, and that, you know, maybe it sparks them wanting to tell their own story one day as well.
In the book, you also talk about the language barrier that the little girl, your main character, experiences. What do you say to the assumption that, you know, because your family is Honduran, that you're fluent in Spanish?
Yeah.
Has that ever happened to you where someone's like, oh, you know, you're Honduran, you know, right?
I think maybe it's more of a, you know, internal issue that I've been dealing with for my whole life of just wanting to be more fluent. But of course, being in situations where maybe you're expected to know more than you do. I just kind of find it amazing that there's always ways that you can really connect with people despite, you know, maybe knowing only a little bit of the language. And so it's hopefully a good reminder that there's lots of ways we can bond with people. And in reverse, there's lots of small things we can do to make other people feel really accepted that might not know our language and understood. But I'm always trying to learn more Spanish.
Aren't we all? My Duolingo is getting mad at me.
Yeah.
It's got like a third eye right now. It's a little weird. What do you say, though, to children of immigrants who may be feeling scared or nervous about sharing their multicultural identities?
Yeah. Another great question.
Is that something you ever experienced yourself? Because you mentioned being half Honduran.
Right. I think that, you know, growing up, Honduras wasn't necessarily in the news as it is today. Maybe that's a lucky thing for me growing up because I don't feel like I had instances where I had to combat that. I think it was more just, you know, having a multicultural background, you're always kind of feeling like a little bit this, a little bit that, maybe not enough this and not enough that. But it's also, you know, a lot of really exciting and cool things that you get to share with people too, you know, as a kid, having been to a rainforest, getting to visit your family in another country, you know. So I feel like it's just kind of a bit of a balancing act.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. 30 seconds left. What's next for you? I know you've got another cool project that's coming up later this year.
Yeah, I was very lucky enough to be illustrating Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor's next picture book. So that releases in September. Another project I have underway is a biography about Cuban artist Wilfredo Lam.
Okay.
Yeah.
So more stuff for us to be on the lookout for from Jacqueline Alcantara. Thank you so much. Congrats
on
the book.
Thank you so much.
Of course. And the book, Teos and Primos, is out now. And that is our show for this Thursday night. If you're looking for things to do this holiday weekend, be sure to check out our website for our summer festival guide. That's at WTTW.com/festivals. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for the Week in Review. We'll leave you tonight with a look at Shy Food Truck Fest that's rolling in culinary delights through Daly Plaza every Friday until October 3rd. Yeah, it's time for that again. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.